Blog Talk Radio.
Labeled by Paul Schaefer of David Letterman Show as the greatest show band of all time, Paul Revere and the Raiders became the vanguard of America's response to the British invasion and were one of the most exciting live shows in the business. Their hits are now seen as bold, unpretentious pieces of 60s rock and roll with a defiant punk edge, which would become the foundation for the development of punk rock. Although they experienced disappointment when they saw another version of Louie Louie become a big hit, they bounced back to sell records in the number second only to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones during their three biggest years of 66 through 69. I'd like to welcome John and David Timmons to the show as we explore Paul Revere and the Raiders with the Timmons Brothers, Paul Revere and the Raiders, Musical Revolution, Part 1. Welcome, guys.
How you doing, John?
John, it's good to be here. This is a topic that Dave and I bring up often at our presentations, our trivia shows, Paul Revere and Raiders. We are not shy to say we're fans, and we thought it was about time that we gave them their due respect because we feel that the critics in many cases do not – well, some critics do give them respect, but it needs to be brought more to the forefront, their story.
And the music people themselves give them a lot more credit than some of the critics do, and they deserve their due. And I hope after these shows, if the Hall of Fame ain't listening, they should be listening.
Well, David, that's a great question. And when this is one that, you know, Paul Revere and the Raiders fans are always talking about, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the criteria, who goes in, why they go in. And there's always been bands that have this wrapped around that. I would like your opinion. Let's start off with you, David. What do you think it is that pulls people in, they get voted or they get brought into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? What are some of the bands that you think probably shouldn't be there? You can say that if you don't want to. You don't have to offend anybody if you don't want to. But then why do you think there are some bands out there that aren't involved in that and haven't been nominated?
Well, my opinion on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I won't name the bands I don't think it should be, because I don't want to make them artists angry, but I can think of several bands that should be in there right now. One of them is Paul Revere and the Raiders. I believe Grand Funk Railroad should be in there. And all you people up there in the Cleveland area, you have to agree with me, the Raspberries, I think they should be, and the Moody Blues. But I think it comes to one thing, what always hurt the Raiders. The Raiders was more than a rock and roll band. I compared them. There's a mixture of the Marx Brothers and a rock and roll band. If you watch Hard Day's Night, the Raiders, typical Raiders could have been made that same movie as the Beatles did, because their comedy, this got part to it, and there wasn't no more of a televised band than the Raiders were for their stretch. And I think the Hall of Fame holds that against them a little bit because they were on TV so much, and they called it overexposure. But I just, that's my opinion. I'll see what John says.
Well, I think that entertainment goes along with music, and in my opinion, the Raiders was able to fuse both of them together well. I mean, to perform those songs live and do all as far as the choreography and get the fans all hyped up, as well as they probably had the busiest schedule. And I'm sure there were some bands extremely busy from 65 to 67. But when you think they were releasing albums, they were doing singles, they were doing a TV show, it was every day of the week, yet they were still finding time to tour. They were probably one, if not the hardest working rock band of their time in about a 3-year period there. And I think that needs to be acknowledged. I think also what's sometimes forgotten is that they had been a group a good 4 years or more working the dance circuit, playing live sometimes hours and hours at a night. So they had crafted their work for many years, even before they appeared on Where the Action Is in 1965.
Now, let's start off with some of the listeners may not know this, but if I'm correct, they started early in the, I mean, it wasn't one of these things where people think this band picked up when the Beatles came out. They were actually formed at or before the time of the Beatles. Is that correct?
Yeah, 1961.
Yes.
They were formed. If I'm correct on that, right, John? 61.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 61, and they were playing clubs and stuff. And Paul had originally called them the Downbeats. And if you see early pictures of them, they all had crew cuts that airplanes could have landed on. But they started out there in the Northwest, and just like in the Legend of Paul Revere song, Mark Lanzi had not come along yet, and they were playing mostly instrumentals at that time. And then just like in the song Paul Revere, Paul had a restaurant, and Mark Lanzi was delivering the, he was the bun boy, delivered buns, and Mark had been singing in other bands. And then I think, John, am I correct on this? I think Mark joins him late in 61.
A little before that, it was actually okay. A little before that. That was when they had their first top 40 hit with Like Long Hair. But the thing that Paul Revere and Mark Lanzi brought them together was the influence of music. Both of them were highly influenced by Jerry Lee Lewis. Paul Revere really liked the boogie-woogie piano style that Jerry Lee was so known for. And Mark liked the kind of madness of the music, the way that was the passion in Lewis and his music. And there's a story that one night when Paul's band was performing, Mark came there and came up on stage, and he said he wanted to perform a song. And Paul said, "Well, what do you know?" He goes, "Anything by Jerry Lee Lewis." So when Paul hears that, well, yeah, let's do it. I guess Dave was talking about the bun boy at the bakery. The next day, Paul comes across there, the street from the restaurant to the bakery, and there's this guy who's wearing this hat and glasses and so on, and apparently Paul doesn't make the connection, but he said, "Yeah, we had a singer last night." And Mark, it ended up being Mark. Well, how was he? "Oh, he was all right." And he pulls off the hat and the glasses. "That was me," you know. And that really started then. I was like, okay, you're pretty good. And shortly after that, that's when Mark would become a member of the band. And I think at that time they were known as the Downbeats. And that was a name that had been taken from a jazz magazine. So this was even prior to becoming Paul Revere and the Raiders, and they were becoming a force in their home state, which was Idaho at the time, with that great Northwest sound. Them and a group called the Wailers were the two that were really bringing out that Northwestern sound.
Now, you talked about, you know, they were, how old were they at that time? Because that's like early 60s. So we're talking, these guys are playing, Paul Revere is a young man. Is he in his 20s at that point?
Yeah, I think at that time, John, he probably was about 22, 23 maybe, you know, right in that age. And then Mark was in his teens. He was probably only 18 or even 19 at most.
Yeah.
And so
barely
they
out
were
high school, yeah.
So they were really young, but Paul Revere being really known for, as far as his business type of acumen, he was ahead of his peers. He was already owning a barber shop. He had gone to barber college. He was also a barber. He had bought a restaurant. He'd done all this while he was in his early 20s. Plus, he was running a rock and roll band, which
so
is amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing. And I think that's when I was, you know, thinking about this show, I was looking at that part, guys, because it's like, I don't know how many interviews I've had with people in bands, and some of them extremely successful, and some of them last, you know, like the Mayfly. They're here and they're gone. They just don't, you know, it's like a great idea, but it is a business. And I'm glad you brought that up, because being in a rock band or being in anything successful is a business. So when we look at Paul Revere being a young entrepreneur and doing all these different things and being able to handle money and being able to invest money and being able to know what to spend on and what not to, that would be so valuable to someone getting into the fact of when they started getting famous. How do you think that tied into it? Because to me, that might have been the reason that they succeeded, or not, they had the talent, but also a lot of bands have talent, but they don't have the business sense or the idea of what to do with their money or how, what, some of them didn't even handle their money. They just got on stage and after it was over, they found out that they had no rights to their music. What do you guys think of that? The business side of Paul Revere doing that as an early person, early young guy, learning how to do that, and that, how did that feed into their success?
I think with Paul, he'd already been in what I call the business world, owning all these stores and restaurants. When he stepped into it, he knew that the money side of the rock and roll game, where a lot of them young bands at the time didn't have that patience. I think it was because he showed a little bit more maturity than some bands, and he just didn't jump into the fire, as they call it. And he knew what he wanted, what sound he wanted, and how to invest his money. And he knew how to find good musicians to put together. And I think John will agree with me. He just didn't pick out the pieces and just throw a band together. He took his time, put the pieces together, didn't he, John?
Yeah, he did. And the other thing with Paul Revere, with his knowledge and early on in terms of business, he knew that there's nothing better than going out yourself to promote a record. And he really single-handedly went out with the song Like Long Hair and throughout the Northwest just took it from place to place and did his own promotion. And I think most artists that young, that early on, would not think that, okay, we have to do this ourselves, because they'd be more concerned, well, I got the creativity, I got to develop the next song, next album. He saw the importance of the business side. And that would continue throughout the history of the band. Paul was a mastermind as far as running the business and making money. And it really paid off, because I think when he connected with the person who was a DJ in Portland, which was Roger Hart. The two of them was really a great team together, because Hart was working at the most popular radio station, had the best time of the day, and so he would take more of the part of reaching out to the public and getting to know, whereas Paul knew how to take it out to the business places and to the radio stations and things like that. So it was a good combination when the two of them end up sort of collaborating. And in some ways, I think you could say Roger Hart was the Raiders what Brian Epstein was to the Beatles.
I agree definitely, John, and because you think of what Roger Hart, because he took all the worries of some of the business things off their minds, which we know can disintegrate a mind. Roger Hart said, I'll take care of this part of it. You boys take care of what you're supposed to do. And I think it makes a big difference.
Now, what do you guys know about, and I don't know if you know this or not, but a lot of times when those groups would it formed in the 60s, they were so excited to get record deals and they were so excited to get on tours that they didn't really read the contracts and they didn't really know exactly who was owning the rights to the music and who was getting paid and how much. What do you know about Paul Revere and the Raiders when it would go to that kind of a situation?
Well, I'll let John answer this one.
I really have not heard the whole account of this, of how much rights they maintain, and so I'm a little hesitant to say they had a lot, because I think and there might be some people listening could actually elaborate on this, but I think Dick Clark maintained a lot of the authority as far as the rights to some things, as far as what he could do with it. Now, I don't know to what extent, but I would not say the Raiders, I would not use a word like they were duped, because I think they actually came out all right, like compared to how you hear some artists. But if I can give one example, we can't buy DVDs of Where the Action Is or the later Raider shows, and my understanding is the Dick Clark estate has such a contract that the Raiders, even though it was their shows, they can't not necessarily always they can't have access to it to produce it. Now, that's my understanding. Now, I could be wrong on that, but that was one point of view.
Hey, John, can I bring up another point? One point, Mitch Miller. Mitch Miller of Columbia Records. Mitch Miller, old sing along with Mitch himself.
Yep.
He gave the Raiders a rough way to go with Louie Louie, which we'll probably get in more about this. They would have been ahead of the Kingsmen, but Mitch Miller and with control of Columbia just didn't see eye to eye with rock and roll bands on the Columbia label. But I got to give Paul Revere credit; he got them on that Columbia label. But we'll talk about more about that. I just wanted to bring that up real quick.
Well, that's a great point, because I don't know if listeners know that they're. You know, people think that their recording would have been out first, and that record made the Kingsmen what they are today. And when you think of the Kingsmen, you think of Louie Louie. Now, they had a couple other songs, but that was the song that broke out. Every kid in the world, including me, played it on their guitar.
John and I did too.
Yeah, I'm not saying I played it well, but I played it. You could tell what it was, I think. But that's an interesting thing, too. So you're thinking, okay, so the record companies, they have the power to release songs, not to release songs. They do all these testing. They go out and say, oh, this is going to be a hit. This isn't going to be a hit. So they're thinking that. While that's going on, the Kingsmen, which were on another label, but from the same area, right? Or were they from the same? Yeah, what label were they on? Because I heard that they were, you know, closely related to each other in the
I believe, John, am I correct? They was on the One label, would have been connected.
One label, WAND.
The
ironic thing about this, John, from all accounts, both Paul Revere and the Raiders and the Kingsmen recorded their songs of Louie Louie at the same recording studio in Portland, probably within days of each other. And the big debate is who recorded it first. Some accounts, the one that I can find seems to actually make sense, says the Raiders' recording date was by the CBS Archives, April 25th, 1963, while it appears the Kingsmen recorded in early May of 63. But the problem was, even though the Raiders recorded first, if they would have stuck with their local label, which at the time was the Gardenia label, and they would have had more control, which they did in the Northwest and became a hit in the Northwest, they relied on Columbia. And you think, hey, big Columbia Records, you know, big power, they can really promote us. And here comes the name Mitch Miller in Columbia Records, who was not familiar with rock and roll.
We'll Miller, sing along better, with Mitch.
Better known for like albums like Andy Williams' Days and Wines of Roses and the easy listening sound. And so they did not know how to promote a rock record. And the combination of Mitch Miller did not like rock, sure did not help. And saw it as just a passing fad. It'll go over. And so Columbia didn't do much to promote it, and here comes the Kingsmen all the way to number one, or in some areas.
But here's the key thing I say about this, John. This is my opinion. let's say if the Raiders had made a big hit with Louie Louie, would they end up like the Kingsmen in a couple of singles and been gone? I think it made them try harder. I really do. I think when they decided, well, if this ain't going to do what want, the only one that got discouraged, John, if I'm right, was Doc Holliday after this, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Mike Holliday, which was one of the original Raiders, and he got kind of down because, you know, you're with a band, you work hard and hope to get that going with you. But then again, they made the song Louie Go Home, and from over in England, John, we know who recorded that, David Bowie. And I believe he recorded, John, in 65, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, Bowie records a Revere Lindsay song.
Well, that makes it so interesting to me, too, because you think back at that period of time. They didn't know what their future was. We're looking back at it, but they didn't know that. In the last couple of weeks, I've been reading up on Tommy James and the Shondells and how amazing that story is. And when I've listened to some interviews from Tommy James, he was talking about when they were from Michigan and they had Hanky Panky and they had it out there and they put their demos out and they were in New York and all these records, you know, companies and all that was going on. And then it was picked by Roulette Records, which had kind of a shady reputation. And all of a sudden, all the big companies just said, no, we don't want anything to do with it. And they went to Roulette Records. And he looks back at that and he said, well, if we would have gotten, you know, chosen by one of these big record companies, we would have probably been a one-hit wonder, like you were saying, David, with Paul Revere and the Raiders. He said the same thing because he said they would have probably put Hanky Panky out. They would have tried us to get us to repeat that same style, and we probably would have failed, and I wouldn't be here talking to you today. So he said that with Roulette Records, they gave them creative responsibility. They could do whatever they wanted. He said they never said you can and cannot do this type of music. Now, after Louie Louie, like their first song was Like Long Hair, and then they did Louie Louie, correct? So that's pretty basic rock and roll right there. So where do you think where did it go from there? They recorded Louie Louie. It didn't. Did it chart at all, guys, or was it? How did it work out?
If I'm right, it charted more in the regional hit for them, didn't it, John, I believe?
In the Northwest. And John, yeah. I think nationally, I'm not sure if it even cracked the top 100, you know, but it did well in the Northwest, and my understanding is the West Coast. Paul was quoted years later as saying, had he known Columbia wasn't going promoted, he would have done like he did with Like Long Hair and gone and traveled from station to station and pushed Louie Louie, because that's what he did in the Northwest. And at first, it was the hit version of Louie Louie in that part of the country.
Well, with the Raider live shows, it actually stood out better than in the Kingsmen's, because it was always Smitty that actually introduced the song, didn't he, John, behind the drum set for Louie Louie.
Yeah, I'm laughing because I had a conversation with someone recently, and they thought that was the Kingsman version where you go, grab your woman, you know, it's Louie Louie time. I said, no, I said, that's the drummer of the Paul Revere Raiders, Mike Smitty Smith, and I said, that's what the Raiders were known for, and it was like their signature song for many nights at the teen dances and so on. I would agree with what you were saying, that it ended up being a blessing, looking back, hindsight, that it was not a national hit. Because
I think it made them be more determined, John. Don't you think so, too, that we can show what we can do?
Yeah, and it ended up being, like, I guess, kind of a springboard to, let's see where we can go from here. And they were best known for performing live with their energy, and they would just blow people away with their live shows. And
they'd actually take a handsaw and cut up Paul's piano.
Or he was set on fire.
There's a picture of them, and I got the deep film of this, and one of them's got a handsaw. I don't know if it's Drake or which one of them. Paul's trying to play the piano. Mark's trying to sing, and he's taking his saw and sawing up the piano. They just, when they got on stage, they were known, and John will agree with me, they known as the Zany Minstrels, weren't they, John?
That was their nickname, the Zany Minstrels. And for good reason. And to your question too, John, like, you know, where did they go from there? I think there was a period that they were kind of disappointed, but I believe it was after the as far as the disappointment with Louie Louie that they adopted the uniforms with the tricorn hats and the and
how this all came about. Mark and Paul are getting ready to play a dance. Well, they're walking uptown, and there's a costume shop. Lo and behold, there's five Colonial uniforms. Well, they looked at it. Mark looks at him. Your name's Paul Revere. So they rented the uniforms for that night. Well, the kids go hog wild in them uniforms. And they put on their show, and they're going wild and yelling. Well, they come back to the same area 2 weeks later without the uniforms, and all their fans said, where's the uniforms? And Paul Revere right then said, the uniforms are going to click. So that's where the three-corner hats and the blue jackets got developed, didn't they, John?
Yes, that was the beginning. And you got to remember, this was like, I don't know, late 64, early 65 probably, give or take. What's going on in the world of popular music? It's the British invasion. So what better than a group called Paul Revere and the Raiders bring out the tricorn hats and the revolutionary uniforms? What
brings,
a great thing for America's response.
And then this brings in Dick Clark. The British invasion is coming really strong, which we talked about during our British invasion shows. Dick Clark had always worked with Bobby Darin, Neil Sedaka, and all them. We need somebody to counter the British invasion. Of course, we got the Beach Boys then, but what better group when you got five guys in revolutionary suits and counter the British invasion? The kids are loving them all over the Northwest, and we're building up to the point now where Dick Clark is developing where the action is, like we heard in the song. And so I think Dick Clark invites them out to California, if I'm right on that, right, John?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so they get all established, they get going there, and I'll let John continue on this, but this is where they finally get their big move.
Okay.
Yeah,
so we got what I'm thinking is, so we've got these guys and they're business savvy and they're good musicians, and they know that it takes a lot to get people's attention because there's so much out there. So this was happening before the British invasion. So when you said that they were walking down the street, David, and they saw, you know, the revolutionary outfits, was that after the Beatles came out or before?
This was John. Well, this is late in 1964, I believe.
Yeah,
right,
my understanding is the British invasion had already hit. Was my understanding?
Started,
it might have been,
yeah. The Beatles have already been over, and so had Jerry and the Pacemakers, and so they knew about this, and when they seen these uniforms, and like I said, that this way a businessman Paul Revere was, and seeing these uniforms, which he thought was going to be a one-night stand with them uniforms, lo and behold, what would become a tradition. Basically, that's how they originally would become the Paul Revere and the Raiders with them uniforms. Once they got them, it just like automatically took off.
Well, I think that's such an interesting thing because you've got so much going on there. You've got a brand new type of music knocking Dick Clark out of the limelight with all of his American bands. Now you've got all the kids, and this is the key to this, I think, guys. You have, once you get the attention of the teenage population and their money or their parents' money, you've got it. You're in. So
yep.
Now they're thinking, okay, we've got these bands. Now, here comes these guys across the sea, and they're not going to see Bobby Darin anymore. And that movie, that thing you do, was really good because it depicted those guys who go on tour, and the Beatles just like, bam, people just changed. They just went from, okay, this music is pretty cool. Now this music isn't cool at all. And now you've got these guys, you talked about Paul Revere being a businessman. How about Dick Clark? I mean,
yes.
Come on.
Well, Dick Clark saw this. Well, Dick Clark was hesitant at first to go with groups because you got to remember he was always in Philadelphia. He had his Fabians. He had his Frankie Avalons there. And yet he was a businessman. He said, well, I got to find me. He knew he had to find a group. And John, you can quote me on this. He needed the Raiders, basically.
Now, we have a caller, area code 702. Do you have something to ask the Timmons brothers?
Yes. My name is John Osborne.
Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
How you doing?
Oh, John.
We're doing great, man.
Well, I was just actually talking to John Timmons yesterday. We had a little conversation, but adding on a little bit to what you guys were saying, it was there's actually some video when the Raiders did some the original core Raiders without Paul in 97 when a DJ on, I think it was Kissin' Radio, I forgot what station it was in Portland, and they were talking the story of Louie Louie, and for the most part it's correct, but it's been kind of noted through time how it went, and I guess what happened was is that they were, like you guys said, were both going through some street where there was some kind of a costume shop. They seen it, and just as a gag, and I think Mark Lindsay quotes this as a Los Oswego show they were doing that weekend, they came on with their La Jolla jacket. They called them La Jolla, and I don't know how it's really said, L-A-G-O-L-L-A, however that's said, La Jolla or La Jolla.
Yeah, I've heard these, yeah, John, yeah.
And they were basically collarless blazers. And you might have seen some archive photo of those just before the colonial outfits. But anyway, so when they rented them, they really didn't think, really, probably didn't really think much of them, I think. I think it was just more or less, let's just put these on to see what happens. And, you know, it's really kind of all kind of guesswork whether they really put the entire things on or if they just put the hats and the coats or the whole thing. So, but the second half of the show, they came out and everybody was from the audience was, like, really shocked. And like Mark Lindsay said, it's
John,
really
I got
hard.
A question. John, I got a question to ask you. On the Louie Louie song, I know my brother told me you're a big Raider for it. That is actually Smitty that introduces the song, isn't it? Basically, when
it
they
is.
Take off on it.
It is. I think people mistook it for either Paul or Mark, but that was Smitty. Yeah.
Now was Doc
and,
Holliday?
And the reason why
Doc
the song
Holliday
didn't
with
take
him
off,
at that time. Now was Doc Holliday with him at that time too?
I know it was Steve West playing guitar. Mark, Paul, I think the bassist was probably Mike Holliday because he came just prior to Phil Volk. So I think it was him playing bass
okay.
on that. But that little tagline onto this was the fact that the reason why Louie Louie didn't make it, it wasn't for anything except one person primarily, a guy named Mitch Miller. Who you
agree
remember
with
as a guy who...
Yeah.
Who was in
the
LA? He was the guy who was in charge of Columbia those years, and he hated rock and roll. And he told the people not to promote that song, and they didn't. The song died, pretty much.
Hey, John, I want to bring up a point to you. He was even against Bob Dylan coming to Columbia. So that's how
I'm sure he was.
Yeah, so that thing. Very interesting.
Well, my guests tonight is John and David Timmons, and I think we need a couple more Johns on the show. My name is John. We have
not
John Osborne. John, talk. I know you have a website and a Facebook page. Talk to the audience out there about how they can access that and what the links are for that.
Well, I started a website called Just Like Us. And it basically features the band. It, you know, archives the band on their accomplishments and the things they've done. The theme of it is live, meaning that when you go to it, it looks like a website that you're almost going to go climb into for a live show that they did back in the mid-60s. Almost all the shots are shots of them playing. There's no really still shots. So that's the theme of it. But it, when you look through it, I guess I want people to get the idea these guys were not just the Hudson brothers or the DeFranco family. These guys,
we're like all different.
Were,
I love
Hudson
the Hudson
brothers.
You know, and my editorials, they kind of lead to that too. So for those of you out there that don't that like the DeFranco family, please do not read this website because you won't like it. the Raiders to me were a very serious band. I mean, they weren't that serious, but when it came to music, they were. You could obviously tell they left the comedy on the table outside the recording studio because the Collage
John,
album
I got a
is
question
about as serious
now,
album as it gets.
Yeah.
Huh?
Hey,
I'm
John,
sorry?
On this question, do you think the Hall of Fame holds that against them? Calls of their stage show.
Well, David, you have
to be honest with you.
Talking to the right John.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, David says John, and I told him you got to make sure you're talking to the right one because
yeah,
there's
right.
Three
yeah.
I was asking John
Osborne.
I know he's a Raider fan. We got so many Johns I know, and
yeah, that's true. The Rock Hall is a joke, honestly. It
I
really
agree
is. And for those of you that listen out there that have connections to the Rock Hall, sorry, but this is my opinion. It really is a joke. It's more political than it has anything to do with musical accomplishments. And this is another one of my Hudson brother comments, but he just recently put in Joan Jett, who, to my knowledge, has two primary hits that anyone knows about. One of my websites is a site called Crisco Party DJs. I'm a DJ myself. And one of the pages in there is a page listing that says John's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I don't have a building, and I don't have people coming to induct certain people into the hall. I consult with a very few people who are deep into music like I am and induct the people who I know belong. There is no people that make my list are people that have more than one primary hit. Their albums have got to be as good as the songs, the singles were. And so for those reasons, there's a lot of people that I have not inducted that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, actually in New York, it's just the museum is in Cleveland, in New York that they have inducted that I haven't. And there's also people I have inducted that they haven't. So I'm kind of on both ends of that. I guess maybe what you're leading to is, do the Raiders belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? And I don't think see where there's any doubt in my mind.
I agree. I bet
they,
my brother Don agrees with you.
Absolutely do, and it's just, for me, it's sickening. It's sad that there's people there that really do belong. People like Chicago, Three Dog Night, the Raiders, the Monkees. I know some
Grand
people
Funk
question
Railroad.
The Monkees because of their, you know, because of how they were not together and all that stuff. But the albums were there, the songs were there, and that's what I go by. And so with the Raiders, for me, it's not even much of an argument. There's some question on the Wrecking Crew and all that stuff that they played on certain records, and they did, but it wasn't that they played on every single project. You know, there were spots here and there that they played on because obviously with the Raiders it was a bit different because they were a working band, not a band that did a tour every summer. They toured 365 days a year. Every year they were a business, more or less, not so much a band, although they were both. So that's my take on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If it were up to me, I'd let everybody have whatever it is that they gave to the museum, and I'd take a bomb and blow it up. and do it all over. because they really need to do that. They really need to seriously look at the people they've left out, who I consider, if you're going to put in Green Day, which they just did, you know, I'd like to take a swift
Ramones,
kick in the
John Osborne,
butt to the person that voted on them.
Hey John, I got to tell you one thing. You do speak your mind, Mr. John Osborne. But John, you got one thing. And my brother John, and JD agrees.
Yeah.
I know you speak with your heart about the Raiders, and I love hearing that.
Well, I'm going to throw this is John Darlington. I'm just going to throw it in real quick about the Rockmore Hall of Fame. I agree with what you're saying, John Osborne, but I'll tell you what I've experienced is whenever these bands, and you can name a few that say, I don't think we should, you know, blah, 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 we should be in and all this stuff. But when they get invited, they're all in because it is an honor. I think it really is. And I think even though there's a lot of people that don't like how they get in and the way they get in, and there's politics involved in everything, there's politics involved with Cub Scouts. So it's going to be politics with everything there is out there. But I think once somebody actually gets that, they really like it. Because you were talking about Joan Jett. Well, Ricky Bird is – I don't know if you guys know who Ricky Bird is, but he was the lead guitar player for Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. And I follow him a little bit and talk to him from time to time. And he's like a kid in a candy shop. I mean – say they should be in, say they shouldn't be in, but he played with Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney.
That's
so,
a big time.
Yeah. I mean, just this
big
last
time.
Week. Yeah, and so I'm thinking, yeah, I understand that. I think without a doubt they should be in. And I know that it's political, and I think they will get in. But I also think that a lot of times when people think, well, you know, I know Los Lobos is a band that really should be in. And a lot of I don't know if you guys agree with that or not, but a lot of people think they should be in. But
well, you know, John, you're mean you're both Mott the Hoople fans. We would be happy if Mott the Hoople in there.
Well, I'm going for the Hudson Brothers into the Hall of Fame. I'm kidding. I'm joking. But,
you know,
but,
I mean, look, guys, when it comes to, like, Joan Jett, right? I mean, I heard what you said about this lead guitarist. For me, it's not about who's in the band. And my hall, if you ever do look at my listing, it almost goes like the Baseball Hall of Fame. There's a player, I don't know if you're familiar with baseball much, his name is Craig Biggio. And this guy, he never
Houston
took
Astros.
Steroids. Pretty much, right. And he pretty much did it with his own natural talent. It took him almost 10 years to get in. And this guy really should have been a first ballot Hall of Famer. But because they stringently look at what you do, what you've done, your numbers, everything, and even probably so much how you are as a person. And so, you know, he did finally make it, but they made him go through the ringer when he finally did. Myself, as the fact that this guy played for Joan Jett, which as a side note, but for me, it's about the albums. It's like I tell people about the Raiders when you go to my site. It's my latest page I just created called Just Like Artist of the Month, meaning that I'm going to be doing, I just did the band, and I'm going to be doing each member of the band. But when it comes to that, you have to look. This is what I tell people, and this is the advice I give people if they come across this website and they want to know who they are. Don't look at the album. Don't even look at the pictures. Put the needle on the record and listen to what comes through your speakers. And just as simple as that. And that's what I've done with pretty much anyone I've inducted into my list. It doesn't really matter to me. Put it like this. Harry Nilsson knew some of the biggest people in rock and roll. He hung out with Ringo, with John. I mean, he knew the biggest of the biggest. Does he belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Probably not. His albums were kind of weird. He was always drunk.
but he always put
not,
the lime
really
in the
was.
Coconut, though. We wouldn't have no lime in the coconut.
Very, yeah. But anyway, there's another guy named Al Stewart did a song called Year of the Cat. And although he was... you know, my friends, when we voted on him, this guy, he knew a lot of big people in rock and roll. I mean, he knew the giants in rock, and so did Gary Wright. who did Dreamweaver. But Gary Wright, to my knowledge, only had one really big album. The one that followed it didn't do so well, and after that his career kind of went south on him. And so as much as I would have loved to put him in, I can't, because it's, the music just isn't there. And so my list is very stringent. It's hard to get into my list because of the fact that I look at your body of music, and it can't just be one hit. It can't be just one album. It's got to be more. It's got to have a body of proof to me. Bryan Adams, I was watching a PBS special last night. That guy just killed. It just makes me disgusted that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame hasn't put him in. This guy is a real talent. He's been a real talent for many years. And I guess the only thing that's failed on him is his hair, because he's got not much left.
That
sounds like Peter Frampton.
That's about it. That's about
that's
it. He belongs. Does Joan Jett belong, in my opinion? No, she doesn't. And
she
neither,
really,
does, and
but
ne-
John,
neither does Harry Nielsen. And
yeah,
neither does Gary Wright. But do I like him? Yeah.
But Joan Jett has cool hair.
She has more hair than I do. I have no hair.
So I think right there, I'm going to get my own website, the Rock and Roll Hall of Hair. My guest is John and David Timmons. We also have John Osborne on with us. We're going to take a music break. We're going to play a couple songs, and we'll come back and continue to discuss the band, Paul Revere and the Raiders, which have made rock and roll history, and we have a solid group of people, including everyone on this call, that believe that Paul Revere and the Raiders should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and we think someday they will. We'll play a couple of songs. We'll be right back and with this show, so don't go anywhere. And we're back on John Talk Radio. Our guests are John and David Timmons of the Timmons Brothers Rock Historians. You can go on their website, timmonsrock.com. They will be on in June 27th at the Mount Sterling Community Center doing one of their trivia shows. And they're going to be back on John Talk Radio on July the 11th for part two of Paul Revere and the Raiders' Musical Revolution. So let's pick it up, guys, from where we were. We were talking about how that they were working very hard to promote Like Long Hair. Then they didn't get the break they needed with Louie Louie. They started to be connected with Dick Clark. So what happened at that point? Where did they go from there? Let's start off with John Timmons.
Well, John, I think that from Louie Louie, as far as recording-wise, I think Columbia Records had to step up and find somebody that knew about rock and roll. And that's where they paired the Raiders with the producer, which would be Terry Melcher, who had recorded, known as the Ripcords, him along with Bruce Johnson, who also would be a Beach Boy, the song Hey Little Cobra. And
right.
They also were, Bruce and Terry had a hit or two there too. So they finally had somebody that had some youth from Columbia that could work with them within the studio. And so that was a step within the right direction that Columbia is trying to finally understand what it is to have a rock and roll artist on their label. And then, as Dave said earlier, when Dick Clark, it was, I think, his secretary saw them performing with the high energy and how they were moving all over the place, and it was just had to be the same time that that Roger Hart, since he had all the connections, got to know the Dick Clark people pretty well and kept putting a good word. Hey, how about Paul Revere and the Raiders? And when it came time to do this pilot for this TV show, it was going to be called Where the Action Is, finally they gave the Raiders a call and wanted them to come to do the pilot, to serve in the band. And I think that was a obviously a big break for them. And that the show actually was signed, except it ended up being on ABC. And so that took off from there. It told them what was going to be their summer plans, which in some ways, though, there was a downside to this that Paul Revere did not like from a point of business. To do all these shows, they probably weren't going to be able to tour as much as they had planned to do in 65. And back then, you had to take what was the wages for the union, since you were a performing artist on TV, which was much lower than what they would have made touring that summer. But in the long run, it gave them all that exposure and ended up being a big, as far as a springboard for the rest of their success.
And then they got to tour with Dick Clark's Caravan of Stars, John, which was a big coup de grace for them, too, when they would go in them caravans. And so it was a shot in the arm, I think. It really got them going.
What's your opinion on that, John Osborne?
Well, you guys have to understand, the primary success of the Raiders came from my estimation, five different guys. Mark Lindsay, Paul Revere, Roger Hart, Dick Clark, and Terry Melcher. And as far as I'm sure that Paul Revere and Roger Hart, who was involved with the band, looked at that deal with Action, even though they had to be highly impressed with meeting Dick Clark, who was obviously a big force in rock and roll. And so I'm sure that Revere wasn't about to give up where the money was, which was, doing the shows. At that time, they were not doing dances anymore. They were doing concerts, and they were packing these places. And so, so they were going to still work. And that's why the recording suffered. Even Revere admitted that later, because, he wanted them to record fast, have a hit fast, and then go back on the road and promote it and just tour. And that's, by the way, as a side note here, that's the reason why there were so many Raiders. Not so much as other bands, because, whoever committed to being in the group Steve, one of the guys I talked to, was next member, left because he wanted to get married. He didn't want to be on the road 75% of the year. And I think that's the reason why there's been so many members of the band come and go. It's just a lot of pressure between touring, recording, press conferences, traveling night after night, you know, on the road, whether it's in a bus or a plane. Of course, the best of it all being chased by girls.
John Osborne, you brought up a good point, too. Being a Raider was always extra pressure because you got to the point where you had to workload on the road. I know I'm jumping ahead of my car a little bit, but Charlie Coe made the comment once, you couldn't come up for air. You was either going to be on a TV show, he's going to be in the recording studio, or you're going to be out on the road. But then again, Paul Revere was a guy that wanted to make money. And so you had to be them points. And I wanted to bring this up. When they toured with the Rolling Stones, which you all know, when the Rolling Stones went out to the Northwest, the Rolling Stones had to open for the Raiders, which is something in itself. That's amazing.
Yeah, Mick Jagger didn't like that. You know, when they told Mick Jagger that information, he didn't care for that much.
Well, we do have a
promoter saying, "Why do we got to open for them?"
We do have a caller. Area code 419. Do you have something to ask the Timmons brothers or John?
Yeah, this is Mike Burney, and
hi, Mike.
I want to say hi to hi Dave and John. I'm wearing your Raiders T-shirt you guys got me.
Oh, all right, you're in good spirit here tonight.
Right. Hey, I just have a question. Is my understanding that Paul and Mark, they did host another show called Happening 68 as a follow-up?
Yes.
Yes, they did.
And that,
yes,
well,
they did. How long
and
did that last?
But JT, you can take that one.
Well, it was started as a Saturday program, of course, called Happening 68. And I think where the action is goes off in April 67, so it takes off in 68, and then it was followed up by It's Happening, which for a while there was actually on Monday through Friday. So they were extremely busy with that. But that was the Raiders that some people nicknamed them, even this, the Happening Raiders, because they were the ones that were running their own TV show so often. It was also on ABC.
And they called them the Rebel Raiders, too. And we'll get more about them in part two, won't we, John?
Yeah.
All right. I thought I remembered that. Thank you for letting me talk, even though my name's not John.
Hey, Mike, you're not alone. There's only
Maybe
one
you should
day
change your name to John.
All right.
Yeah,
thanks
there's
a
still
lot.
Time. You
I appreciate
that.
Your call, Mike.
Now, we also have another caller. I'm going to see if they we'll see if they have something they'd like to say. We have area code 740505. Do you have anything you'd like to bring into the show? I guess not. Well, that's good. Some people do, some don't. So let's continue on with what I would say would be the turning point. Now, John Osborne, you made a really interesting point to me where they were so busy doing the TV show and they were so busy touring, and it might have hurt their recording. Now, being on TV all the time like that, how did they keep up having material to put on the shows and having single releases? How did they keep up with that piece? Because they had to be able to have songs, you know, to perform on where the action is and to, you know, to compete with the other groups out there at that time.
Well, they were lucky in the way that they had a in-house a guy that wrote material, who was Mark Lindsay. So I remember Keith Allison telling me one time that they wrote Freeborn Man in Columbus, Ohio, where I'm from, at a Holiday Inn. Him and Mark Lindsay wrote Freeborn Man. And so, they were doing those, were just a Worthy Actionist tour before Keith actually joined the band. But it goes to show you how far back they had been writing, you know. But, you know, Mark was writing the whole entire time they were touring and all that stuff. So, you know, he would write, you know, on the road. I remember him talking about how he was writing I think he said Cinderella Sunshine in his mind. And actually, I think he got the idea from, I don't even know how to say this. It's not that dirty. It's just kind of funny. He's writing it while he's going to the bathroom.
Oh, is that the crapper? Hey, wasn't he, John?
I mean,
Austin,
if he calls in,
the guy's
asking that question, I don't know. But obviously, you know, they must, I mean, you know, they weren't your, a prototypical band that took the winters off. The winters, they toured like the summers. So, you know, Mark was writing, and I'm sure the other guys were writing, you know. Although they didn't get much material on, not later on anyway. Early on they did, Our Candidate, In My Community, and that stuff.
Now, John Osborne, I
so
got
that's
now,
it, you know, that's
now,
how they did
didn't,
it.
Now, didn't Jim Bowery, though, didn't he get kind of teed off that they promised him a song on Spirits of 67?
Yeah,
well, the story
he
I
did.
Heard, that Mark was in the crapper, and they was going to use Jim Bowery's song, Harpo's song, but Mark said, I come up with another song, and I made Harpo, I think that caused Harpo to leave the band because everybody else on Spirit 67 got to do a song besides Jim Bowery. And right, JT?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you just heard from John Osborne there. Yeah, it was Our Candidate, and then you had the Phil Volk song, too.
In My Community, yeah.
In My Community, and I think he also did Why, maybe. I think he had two songs on that one. So, yeah, I'm sure that was a major, as far as a catalyst for Harpo leaving.
He was, Jim Valley's one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet or come across. He runs a website called Rainbow Planet, which is dedicated to kids. He's really a good human being, he really is. But his time with the Raiders, he was actually more of a showpiece. I don't know if you guys knew this or not, even on the record that shows his face. He didn't play guitar on any of those songs.
It was always Drake Levy I heard in the studio. Drake would come in.
Drake played guitar. Jim played it live.
Yes. Jim Bowery, though,
really surprised me. It really did.
Hey, now, John, I got a question for John Osborne. Am I right on this? I believe that basically when Jim Bowery came in, Paul Revere had to coax him to come in because he was in Don and the Good Times with Charlie Coe, and they were starting to get big, and Paul told me, When Drake had to leave for the National Guard, he said, why should you be in a band that's not getting there when you can be with us big stars now? And do you think Jim Bowery would have jumped at that knowing what the situation was going to be down the road? But it did kind of make him famous, though. But
well, yeah, obviously it did. Sure did. You know, I mean, yeah, it made him at least a star for the time. Like I said, I think if he had gotten a song on Spirit, he would have stayed. But because he didn't, and to be honest with you, when he left, Drake came back for a very short time, and then that whole thing came about with him and with Drake and Smitty and Phil going to the Brotherhood, and that became. That really was the end of the first chapter of Paul Revere and the Raiders when they did.
Yeah. Like I said, in part two, John, you brought up some points. JT, he brought up some good points that we're going to go into in part two about the time of the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah, leading up to that, I think that, you know, on tonight here, what I want to make a comment on is and Terry Melcher and his influence and how he changed our music. Because the songs we just played, like Long Hair and Louie Louie, when Terry Melcher got involved, it was like goodbye Paul's Boogie Woogie Piano, goodbye Mark's Sax, goodbye to Screaming Vocals. He made it more of a controlled sound. He brought in the Vox organ. He brought in the background harmonies. And Terry had a lot of experience with the Beach Boys and surfing style music, and you know, I think he was trying to find a cross section between here's a weird combination: Rolling Stones, Kinks, and the Beach Boys, and trying to find what was the winning formula. And I think that's why, you know, for Melcher deserves a good amount of credit too, along with the success of Mark writing the songs and sometimes co-writing along with Melcher. But nonetheless, two of their biggest hits were not written by Raiders. They're actually written by the husband-wife team of Barry Mann, and it was Cynthia Will, Kicks and Hungry. But the Raiders sure put their personality into it. But and one of you can address this, but my understanding on the song, which I believe there was a song that they were trying to find a sound that was like the Animals, because they were having so much of their own success, and Mann and Well had written, "We Got to Get Out of This Place." And I think it was Melcher that approached them about, saying, "Hey, the Animals are doing really good. Do you have a song for us?" And that's what led to the song Kicks,
the anti-drug song.
Well, when you was talking about, "We Got to Get Out of This Place," I was in Chicago once when I seen Mark Lindsay, and he told a story of that. And the only reason why actually that didn't become a Raider hit is because Mark Lindsay wasn't in town to record it. And Columbia wanted that song done that day or that next day, and it was imperative to get done like right then. And Lindsay couldn't get away to come back to California and get that done, and that's why they gave it to the Animals. Otherwise, that would have been a Raiders hit.
So that would have been a Raiders hit.
Yeah,
well, John,
Kicks, on the other hand, was going to be a Raiders hit no matter what.
John, I want to ask this to John Osborne. I want to ask you this question. We're men Raider fans. When they decided to make Great Airplane Strike, didn't they want originally to make I'm Not Your Stepping Stone a single before the Monkees did?
That's the whole Kicks Stepping Stone thing.
Yes, yes.
You know,
and I heard they wanted that. And I think they decided to go with the Great Airplane Strike because it was in the news at the time, but it didn't chart as good as I think it would have been if they would have been one step ahead of the Monkees with I'm Not Your Stepping Stone. So it makes you wonder sometimes on their decisions what songs they wanted.
Well, you know, Lindsay's done some shows. He did a couple of years ago a show called The Teen Idols Tour with Peter Noon and Mickey Dolenz, and Lindsay came up with an idea when Dolenz comes on and does Stepping Stone for him to interrupt him and say, "Hey, dude, what are you doing?" And he'd say, "What?" And he said, "This is my song. What are you doing my song for?" You know, and basically
so
it's the controversy, and always been for decades now, who did the song better, who did it first? Well, the Raiders recorded it first.
Oh,
who did it better depends on who you are. The Monkees did a good job with it, too. Although it really wasn't the Monkees.
John,
that song was actually done by the Wrecking Crew. The Wrecking Crew recorded Stepping Stone, not the Monkees.
For everything for the Monkees.
Not the four Monkees, anyway.
Yeah, but the key thing I heard, too.
Here's the story how it goes, what I heard that Lindsay talked about. They had just recorded Stepping Stone. They were about to release it, and then Manuel came to them with Kicks and said, "Look, we got a song for you." They listened to it. They really liked it a lot. They were going to release Stepping Stone as a first song. They apparently, whoever they is, decided to release Kicks first, then release Stepping Stone as a second single from the album. Well, when they went to go tell Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart that news, they weren't really that pleased to hear that news, that Kicks was going to be the first single. So they turned around gave it to the Monkees.
Is that how the Monkees came about basically getting that then? Basically.
And Mark Lindsay tells this story. Mickey Dolenz kind of not copies his voice style, but how he puts this, but his, like, how he, the breaks between songs. I mean, Boyce and Hart didn't tell the Monkees or whoever it was, the Wrecking Crew, whoever he told, that this was the Raiders. He said, "I want you guys to play it exactly like this," and so they did. And they asked Mickey to sing the song. He came in with the Wrecking Crew, and they recorded the song, and that's how it became a Monkees song.
Yeah. Hey, let me ask you, all three of you guys, what you think of this. Let's say if they would have went with I'm Not Your Stepping Stone, and I want all three of us, well, I wonder what we all think. Do you think I'm Not Your Stepping Stone would have charted higher than Kix if they'd went with that direction? What do you think,
Keith?
You know,
it's something I actually know about. They actually said that Stepping Stone actually did chart higher than Kix.
It actually did?
But that's,
okay.
I guess so. I mean, I only heard that just about a year ago. I actually didn't know which one was bigger.
Well, it's kind of obvious
now because younger bands know Stepping Stone.
John Osborne, I'm
in Las Vegas, and I heard it on Fremont Street, just some local band here, and they was playing Stepping Stone. So it was obvious to me what hit bigger in the long run. So,
well, you know, David Bowie caught wind of Louie Go Home, and JT can testify this. Bowie charted, and I don't think he was calling himself David Bowie yet, was he, John? It was Davy Jones.
He was calling himself Davy Jones, and he had to change
And that's where he became Bowie on account of he had to interfere with one of the monkeys.
Now, we do have a caller.
That's kind of funny, you know, when you think about that.
A 740-505.
I got to get out of here. I got to get ready for work. But anyway, you guys take care of yourselves. It was great talking to you.
Thanks, John.
Hey, John,
we appreciate
good talking to you.
Take care, guys. Bye.
We do have a caller, 740-505. Do you have a question for the Timmons brothers?
Yeah, I have a question for John Timmons.
Okay, he's right here.
Hey, John.
Hey, you're wearing your Paul Revere and the Raiders T-shirt.
Yeah. I got it still rocking. That it says 40 years, Paul Revere's autograph on it. Junior's the man that got me this Paul Revere and the Raiders T-shirt. I wear it to many of the shows. It's my most prized T-shirt. And I think it was at the time still rock after 40 years, and that thing's even more valuable now. And everywhere I look at it, I really, really appreciate you getting that for me because that's become quite a item to be a collectible now. So thank you.
Well, you're welcome, my friend. I'd just like to see or hear if you would tell the audience and listeners how cordial Paul Revere was when you met him.
I'll let Dave tell the story because Dave likes talking about this. I'll just give the setting. I think it was August 3rd, 1979, Americana Amusement Park outside of Hamilton. Dave Timmons, you can take it from here.
Okay, this is a great story. All three of us, JD, are sitting drinking milkshakes. Well, Junior's got a pair of binoculars, and he said, that looks like Paul Revere over there setting up the equipment at the park. John said, oh, no way Paul Revere would set up his own equipment. And I said, well, let me have the binoculars. I take a look. I said, John, take a look. It's actually Paul Revere. John Grant said, let's go over there. So we all walk over there, and the first thing we do, none of us can say a word. Our mouths drop on. We're looking at Paul, and when John finally says, how you doing, Uncle Paul? And he says, how you guys doing? He just as down-to-earth a gentleman as could be. And John asked him, he said, where's Mark Lindsay? What did he call him, John? T.I.?
You mean T.I.? Teen Idol.
Yeah, Teen Idol. But Junior brought up a good point. He took time to talk to us. We actually had Paul Revere to talk to just for a half an hour. He didn't ask whatever we wanted to ask him and stuff. And Junior even got to hold his beer, didn't you, Junior?
Yeah, I sure did. And he asked me not to drink it.
He said he needs somebody to hold the beer. So we really were close there. But, hey, Junior, that's a good story. I'm glad you had me bring that up.
Yeah, it was really great. It was a highlight of meeting him, that was for sure. And, again, how cordial he was to us.
Oh, he was a gentleman. And I tell you, Heaven's got a great organ player up there now, I'll tell you.
Well, what did they say in that
one
part two? There was this one cartoon came out, and it was showing him going, it was up, he was on and one of the escalators going upward to heaven, and he's at the gates, and they're saying, hey, we have a good thing coming now. It's Paul Revere and the Raiders. You know?
Yeah, they had that picture. That was such a nice picture. They say, here comes a good thing. And like I said, hey, Junior, appreciate you calling, buddy.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Take care. Thank you for the call. Okay, guys, so we have about 15 minutes left in this part one. What else do we need to cover, John and David, in the first part of what is important for people to know about Paul Revere and the Raiders?
Well, here's a part that we haven't recognized yet tonight, and people may not know this. Jimi Hendrix is also from the northwestern part of USA, and he was in the audience, and he wasn't known himself yet. And this was like 1964, maybe, watching the Raiders, he was so impressed with Drake Levin as the lead guitarist. He would meet Drake and later and tell him, "You really inspired me." He goes, "On what?" He goes, "The way you put the guitar behind your head, your neck, and kept on playing it." And that's why Hendrix added that to his repertoire, because he thought it was so neat how Drake was able to do that. And that was one of his early, as far as people that really was sort of inspired him. And so that's a story you don't often hear. The other thing I would want to point out is that the core Raiders and the main group that we usually think about, John Osborne referred to them as Mark Lindsay, Paul Revere, Drake Levin, Phil Fang Volk, and Mike Smitty Smith. They were actually a band. They worked together. And so some people feel that, and that's why there's going to be a part one, part two, that it was really Paul Revere and the Raiders, and later you would start getting the featuring Mark Lindsay. However, here's something I found out in my research. Actually, on the album Here They Come, it was in small letters featuring Mark Lindsay, but it would not come out again on an album cover until Drake, Mark, and Fang had gone from the band. And it'd be the album Revolution, where we'll take off for part two. But I did not know the first album on Columbia actually does say that.
And remember what Fang said, we were not Mark Lindsay's backup band.
Yes. And if Man. And if Mr. Phil Volk could call in, I would think
I'd love
he would
to hear
probably
his
say
version.
That.
He would. But so here's my point, too, about the Raiders. We're at this zenith of time, and John Osborne brought this up, and John did, to JT. I'm going to serve our initials since there were so many Johns, but JT did, too. But the key thing here, this happens with a lot of bands, with the original five. And we talked about during the making of Spirit 67, everybody wanted to have their songwriting time. And I think this is, we're building up, when part two we'll go into this, but I think Drake has seen himself now, don't you, John, agree that he wants to step out now and do stuff. Smitty does. And in all their albums, they all were allowed to do a couple of songs. Well, they're seeing this coming down the road that basically Mark is doing the writing and the singing. And this is starting to build up, ain't it, John, for controversy with the Raiders?
Yeah.
And everything, so in that part.
Well, to me, it seems like the same thing that bites a lot of bands, guys, is that when you have different creative forces in the band and people start thinking about, well, how about me? What about me? I'm waving my hand back here. Ringo Starr felt that way. He felt that the Beatles didn't appreciate him. George Harrison felt that way. I mean, that's just human nature, and that's the things that I think is really important whenever I talk to people in bands. I always ask them about that synergy and what is it. When you guys are starting to talk about now they're popular, people know who they are, they're buying their records, they're on TV, they've got hit records, and then the guys are thinking, oh, wait a minute, are we just a backup band? I wonder if there was any discrepancy in pay for Mark Lindsay compared, or Paul compared to the other guys, or how they distributed the funds. I wonder if that had anything to do with it.
Hey, John, tell JD what Fang said in the interview at one you got on the DVD about when each Raider was talking about Paul Revere. Well, Where the Action, and they interviewed every Raider. Well, they get done with Smitty, and Smitty talks about working with Paul Revere and Mark, and so does, I believe Drake gets done. Then they get to Fang. Fang gets talking about the business and the money and stuff, and Paul says, "Watch yourself, watch what you're talking about." He says, "Paul, you're just greedy." Didn't he, John?
Yeah, it was said, if you had one word to describe each member, and he got to Paul, the word greedy, and Paul's in the background here, watch it now, kind of joking, you're like saying
and everything. And, but yet they know they had, well, I'm going to use the word good thing, they know they had a good thing. Where else could they have been making that kind of money? Here you are on television 5 days a week and the touring. But just like John Osborne brought up, being a Raider, though, you worked 360 days a week. And I think he was right. When we go into part two next in July, that'll explain a lot what happened to one group of Raiders and why the other group came, because the constant touring. They also did the song SS-396 for Oldsmobile, and they did TV commercials. You just didn't come up there being a Raider.
Plus, they had all the teen magazines putting them on the covers and pinups and stories like, what would be Mark's ideal of the perfect date, and things like that. I mean, all the kind of things the inquiring minds want to know.
Well, was a 16 magazine, John, you could get a piece of Mark's ponytail for the girl.
Yes, and then he had there was a program on Where the Action Is that Mark was going to cut off the ponytail, and everybody kept watching. Will he actually cut off the ponytail? I ended up taking off a couple of hairs, I think he cut off, but nonetheless, it was from the ponytail. But all these girls submitted. Cards why they would like to have his ponytail, and I remember him saying in an interview, now whoever gets this, you'll need to wash it with good shampoo and make sure that you use the right kind of conditioner, because that's what my ponytail will need.
Yeah. And John, then there's the incident too. A lot of people don't know the Raiders had injuries. Fang, they was in an open stage, and Fang was doing the famous Raider trot and fell off the stage and broke his leg. Wasn't that in 66, John?
Yeah.
And Drake had to come back and replace him until he got healthy. But you talk about doing the Raider trot, he said he just got carried away.
But if I make one other comment, it's 1965, 66, Vietnam War is going on. Even the Raiders could not avoid it. Even Drake had to serve his time with the National Guard, and that's what took him away from the band for a while. And took him away from the touring, but as you heard earlier, they were still bringing him back for the studio, is my understanding. But even the Raiders were affected by the draft indirectly, because it led Drake to becoming part of the National Guard. And then, John, to address your other question in regards to, like, did Mark and Paul have in their contract and made more? What I can tell from my research, it sounds like, and this is what Paul said when he found out that the three were going to leave for their own band, which is Brotherhood. He says, I made them a fortune. They were all driving brand new cars and had big houses and everything because I made sure I split the pot up with everybody. No one worked on a salary. Everybody got a piece of the pie. So, reading that, now, obviously, I wasn't there to hear Paul say it, but I would interpret that it sounded like everybody got a fair shake. So that was a big risk for these three members to leave a sure thing and Paul Revere Raiders because of their own creativity, wanting to maybe go a different direction with music.
Hey, John,
so it came where it was the artistry over the money.
And John, here we're getting the part up to the Ed Sullivan Show, the climax, which Paul has had a lot of money for a big tour after the Ed Sullivan Show. He has no idea them three are going to leave originally, up to that point, and he invests a bunch of money on a major tour, and so he has no idea at this time till Drake makes the comment about the Brotherhood. Am I right on this? I think it's about that time period, right before the Ed Sullivan Show, because we're talking, he already has Freddie Willer in tow in case he needs him. He replaced Harpo in the band, and when Drake had military ties. So this is all getting built up to that big point.
Well, you make a good point. I think this is going to – we got just a few minutes left. It's going to lead into the part two. As the music scene changes – and as the culture changes, you go from the 60s, they start off in the early 60s. As the culture changes, and John, you talked about the Vietnam era, the psychedelic era was coming. How did that change the band?
They did
Sgt. Pepper. Hey, John, I'll let you finish this, but Mark Lanzi brings Paul Revere an 8-track tape of Sgt. Pepper, and Paul looks at Mark, I read in a book, and he said, where in the hell can we go from here, right, John? I'll let John continue then.
And it's really, it's ironic that it almost sort of parallels with Sgt. Pepper when the band would change over, maybe a month and a half earlier, but close to the same time period. And so the Raiders would change their music. But that's one thing about Mark Lindsay, be it good or bad, he was always aware of what was doing well and had a way of, I guess I'll use the word, sort of sampling, but yet making it a Raiders sound to go into what was hitting well right then. And that's what made the Raiders. They were a band that was really flexible, that would adapt to the sound.
Well, we got to wrap this up, but I appreciate you guys. And just to let you know that Mark Lindsay is going to be with the Happy Together Tour at the Fraze Pavilion this summer in August, and Marcy and I are going, so that'll be fun, be with the Turtles and the Cow Sills, the Buckinghams and the Association and the Grassroots. So,
well, that's like a 60 reunion.
That'll be great. And
tell Marcy, I feel sorry there's no monkeys there, though.
Well, poor monkeys. We're going to have to see them. We'll do that. We'll do our best to see that. And also, I did see where Paul Revere's Raiders will be playing in Tiffin, Ohio in 2016.
Okay.
So,
already
yeah.
scheduled.
Yeah, that's
right there.
What would you like to say in closing, guys? We got about a minute.
I'll be real quick. I'd say we're building up, and part two, we will go into the Southern Raiders and what they did, and I'll let JT take over.
Well, I think the Raiders, hopefully people realize that in the mid-60s, they were one of the biggest hit artists going. They had several top 10 songs. They had the TV show, and the thing about it, I think that people do not realize how popular they were unless they go back and look at the magazines, newspapers at the time, because, as we said from the beginning, they were right there in terms of teen idols with in magazines with the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. And same with record sales.
Yeah, they were big, and I remember that those days. And to tell you the truth, I remember their release of Stepping Stone before I remember the Monkees. I heard the Paul Revere's release first. Well, thanks.
Yes.
Thank you so much, John and David Timmons. You can go on their website, timmonsrock.com. They'll be at the Mount Sterling Community Center on June 27th for one of their trivia shows, and they'll be back on John Talk Radio on July the 11th for part two of Paul Revere and the Raiders, the classic years. Guys, thank you so much. And have a great time.
Thanks, John.
And you guys take care, and we'll talk to you later. Thanks for everyone for listening to the show, and we'll be back next week.
Just you two, not alone. come back down, girl. Still ain't feeling right. Don't it seem like
it just keeps getting harder to find? And all your kids ain't bringing you peace of mind. Before you find out it's too late, girl, you better get straight.
No, it's not good. Run away from here, and if you keep on running, you'll have to pay the price. And don't it seem like
it just keeps getting harder to find? And all your kids ain't bringing you peace of mind. Before you find out it's too late, girl, you better get straight.
No, you don't need kids to help you face the world each day. That road goes nowhere. I'm gonna help you find yourself another way.
It just keeps getting harder to find.
You don't need
all your kids,
girl.
You need some magic before
need
you
help,
find
girl.
Out it's too late,
girl.
You better get straight.
Don't it seem like
it just keeps getting harder to find?
Life.
band, but I know that it's not true. Other than the way he looks at you, and I think you're gonna hang me up again.
Bless.